Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Local Business Network Hour. Local Business Network is Michigan's most powerful business referral organization.
Sorry about that, guys. This is Al Crawford with Networking Squared. The joys of when you do your own studio and do the interviews yourself, sometimes we make mistakes, and that was the introduction, unfortunately, to my other show that I do. Welcome to Networking Squared. Networking Squared has been around for, this is our seventh year, and the focus of the show is to spotlight small business owners in Southeast Michigan. And today we're going to actually be talking to four members of one of the chapters from Local Business Network. Local Business Network is a face-to-face networking organization focused in Michigan and Southeast Michigan, where there's 38 chapters. We'll be talking to four members of a chapter that's actually called the Wayne Oakland Evening Chapter. It's the only chapter in LBN that actually meets later in the day. They actually meet on the second and fourth Thursday of every month at 5:30 p.m. at Bravo Susina Italiano, which is at 17700 Haggerty Road in Livonia. And again, we'll be talking to the president, actually, and the secretary of that chapter on today's show. And we will start today with our first guest. His name is Jason Greifenberg, and he's the owner of CompTool Solutions. And he's been on the show many times, and I'm always happy to have him on the show and to be able to share his knowledge. So we'll bring him on right now. Jason, how are you, buddy?
Good, Al. How are you today?
I'm awesome. You know, unfortunately, the only thing I think of when I hear your name now is I think of your Pac-Man suit.
Aha, that's great.
I love it. For our audience, Jason, and I'm going to ask for a little background on that, but if you're on social media and you click on Jason, he's got this amazing suit that's actually, it's Pac-Man. So what was the motivation behind that suit?
Well, I actually own 12 arcade machines in my basement.
Oh,
and the
wow.
story on that was when I first got married, my wonderful wife Amy, she had said that I could have four arcade machines, you know, no more than four. So I got up to four, and like, oh wow, there's a Tempest machine I need to get. That's five. Oh geez, Miss Pac-Man. So it grew and grew and grew to 12. Then we had kids, and okay, I'll stop at 12. But I grew up in the 80s. I'm a product of the 80s, and my first video game experience is Pac-Man, and I love the game. I remember playing it at Plymouth Kmart arcade back in the day, and it basically springboard my career into electronics, tinkering, and eventually into computers. So a buddy of mine, he was at Kohl's because he's looking for a new job. And he's looking for a new suit. So he sent me a text message and says, hey, Jason, this is all you. This is all you. Boom, within a half an hour, I went to Kohl's, picked it up. It fit great. Love it ever since. I love that Pac-Man suit.
It is. It is actually awesome. So, yeah, cool. And so that's kind of like, it kind of segues into, you know, kind of what you're about. It's one of those things where I think about the issues that people have with computers, all the different things that are going on. And for the last 5 or 6 years, your name is always the first thing to come out of my mouth as far as the person who fixes, you know, these types of things. So, Jason, I wanted to kind of go into some questions that I had for you to kind of spotlight some of the things that you do with your business, okay?
Sounds great. Thanks.
So one of the things that I think comes up for a lot of people when they talk about things with their computers is backing up information. What's the best way to back up my files?
Yeah, so we have a rule of thumb in IT is your data should be basically in three locations. The first location is obviously the actual file itself, whether it's a document, a picture, a video. The second location should be a localized backup. So you can back up your files locally manually by a thumb drive, or you can even get one of those USB hard drives that performs a nightly backup. And third, and most important, is a offsite backup. You can use a program like Carbonite, for example, that automatically backs up your files. Or if you want to go crazy, you can back up your files to a thumb drive and take it home or something like that. The reason why you have to have that third backup offsite for, you know, God forbid, if you ever have a fire or a theft in your home office or your office, the computer is gone, that local backup is gone, but good thing that you have that offsite backup.
And this is a service that you provide, correct?
Exactly. Yep. So we talk to people about these backup solutions, and most of the times, you know, they're very good at their art. Whether they're a CPA or a lawyer, they're very good at their art. But when it comes to technology, they need our help, and that's something we provide to them.
Now, because I know with the onset of the internet and all the different communications and things, are you able to do things in other states, or do you focus strictly in Michigan, or how do your services work?
We mostly focus in Michigan. Our localized clients are anywhere from Saline, Ann Arbor, all the way through Farmington Hills, Livonia, and even some areas in Downriver. But we also have clients. Actually, we have some clients in Florida. And as much as we would like to travel to Florida and help them out, we can use a remote desktop solution where we can actually remote into their computers. So, for example, I maintain about four or five mobile home offices in Florida. And with that, I remote in and I do either like a quarterly maintenance, make sure their virus scans are up to date, or if they have a question, they say, "Hey, Jason, I'm having a problem with my printer. Can you remote in?" And I obviously can, which is a great technology.
Yeah, because I was thinking, my God, if with all the hurricanes and things going on, and to me, people that are in those areas, they face huge loss with water or, you know, all the different things that are happening. And my sister lives in Houston, and, I mean, the amount of loss they had last summer, I was thinking, my God, your services, I mean, how many people had their desktops and their homes that were flooded and they lost everything? And so, you know, so I
exactly.
want people to kind of think out of the box. And say that, you know, that stuff can be protected and it can be done remotely by, you know, somebody like Jason. So thank you. Thanks for that answer. So
no
the other
problem.
Thing I think that people are thinking about is with viruses. So is there any way that I can actually prevent my computer from getting a virus?
Yeah, there are several ways. And without getting into the, I call it geek speak, I'll kind of go overview. First and foremost, you should always and must have a malware program, a virus scan program, such as McAfee, Avast, AVG, Norton. We've heard these names and technologies, but we don't know exactly what they do. So back in the day, they were called virus scanners because all we had was viruses, but now we have malware, which is short for malicious software. And that does include your viruses, your phishing scams. Like, for example, you click on an email, you click on a link, and it asks you, hey, we need your password to log into your Amazon account, which is a phishing scam. You don't want to do that, but that's another story. But first and foremost, you do need to have a virus scanner, a full version virus scanner, and make sure it's up to date constantly. So that's a service we provide. We provide a virus scan solution, and we make sure that it's installed properly, and we also make sure that it's updated every so often because every day it does an update on there. Good news is for our home user listeners out there, if you have internet service provided by either Comcast or Spectrum, formerly known as Brighthouse, they do provide you a free full version virus scanner for home users. They provide either Norton or McAfee up to like 5 to 10 devices, which is a great solution. Now you can have AVG free, for example, or for example, Windows 10 not provide you with Microsoft Defender for free, but those are just high levels. Those are better than nothing, but they don't go deep and protect you from the other malicious software that's out there that protect you. So you must have a full version.
So something else that I think this question comes up quite a bit is that as phones have become more and more another appendage to our bodies, I think people are under the assumption that you can't get viruses on your phone. That's false, right?
Yeah, that is false. Ever since mobile devices became available, with smartphones, they're accessible to the internet. You have your email attached to it, so when you open up that link or that image, it's actually a virus. You must protect it. So there are a handful of malware protection apps on phones as well as tablets, believe it or not. So iPads are susceptible to viruses, believe it or not.
Cool. So something you mentioned a few minutes ago that I wanted to come back to, and it's the word phishing. And I think that has a different meaning than what people may think. So can you explain what fishing is?
Sure. I'm an outdoorsy person. I like to go up north and, you know, fish for real fish, but that's not what this is about. This isn't relaxation time. I wish it was. I wish somebody would send me an email and say, hey, let's go fishing. But basically it's fishing with a PH fishing, not F, PH fishing. So like fishing for information. Somebody that's evil or wants to do harm is fishing or trying to collect information from you. So an example is you may receive an email that says eBay needs to reset your password. So please click on this link, put in your username and put in your old password, and then you can reset your password. There's a security violation. That's not going to happen. The only way that eBay will reach out to you is if you actually initiated a reset password. So the way you can protect yourself is if you hover over that link. So let's say you do receive an email from eBay administration, and it'll look just like legitimate eBay. It'll say security or administrator at eBay.com. That's called spoofing. They're pretending to be somebody else. So if you actually look at the link that's in the email and you take your mouse pointer and hover over it, you'll notice that it'll go to www.tinyurl.blahblahblahblahblah, not eBay.com. Yep. And if you happen to click on it, look at your browser. So when you click on it, it'll either automatically send you to Chrome, Firefox, Internet Explorer, depending what your default browser is. If you look at the URL on the top where you type in google.com or facebook.com, in that URL up on the very top, it'll tell you www.tinyurl or imfishingforyou.com/blah blah blah. It's obviously not eBay. So then, yeah. Right. So close the browser right away, delete that email, and you're good to go.
Okay. And I know for our audience this is going fast, but it's a situation where we only have 15 minutes and we're trying to cover as much as we can. And obviously, you know, when these things come up, if there's something that you're wanting more information, we'll share his contact information at the end. So you're welcome to reach out to him and learn more about his expertise. But a couple more things I wanted to go over, Jason. One of the things that I know in jobs that I've had in the past is that I have proprietary software that was specific to what I did for a living. You know, what do you do or how do you handle implementing those technologies into, you know, what's going on in today's environment?
Sure. Yeah. Most everybody uses a Windows platform, Windows 7, Windows 10, or Microsoft Office, Adobe Acrobat Reader to open up PDF files. Those are the generic across the board. But a lot of businesses, they have proprietary software or software that's specialized to their industry. So we have a tool and die company that uses a program called it's called the bee, and it stings you. And what it does is it actually does CAD drawings for springs and other metal type items, and that's a proprietary software to this spring and tool die company. So with that software, we learn to get acclimated with the software. We get familiar with the software because we are supporting our friends, our clients, and we reach out to the software vendor and we troubleshoot it because our clients, again, they have their art. They do the tool and die. They do a very good job at it. But when it comes to technology, if there's an error or an issue, they just don't know what to do. So that's where we come in. We learn the software, we embrace it like it's our own. And if there's any problems or questions, we can either resolve it ourselves or we actually reach out to the software vendor for technical support.
Nice. What about, I'm going to go tap to some simple stuff. If somebody breaks the screen on their laptop, is that something you can fix?
Oh, yes, definitely. Oh, yeah, we've fixed many screens.
Okay. And then this is something that you actually did for one of my friends very recently, and I wanted to kind of finish with that. You sell and set up PCs and Macs, and it's one of those things where, so you are not, because it seems like that's probably unique, so there seems to be a lot of people that are either their PC or their Mac. They're not both. So you're kind of special in that way, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah, we take care of both equally, Mac, PC, even Linux. Some auto industry proprietary, they use a Linux operating system, so we can definitely take care of those.
Nice, and I really appreciated you taking care of my buddy Jerry. It was when he called me and he said, "This is what I'm looking to do," and I'm going, "Yeah, you're going to need to call Jason." So, and I knew that you were a great resource for that kind of stuff, because I was like, "Yeah, that's really way out of my pay range." So Jason's your guy for that. So thank you for that.
I appreciate the call, Jerry. I appreciate it, and Jerry's a great guy. Thank you so much.
So unfortunately, we are out of time, Jason. What I want to do is I've shared your information on Facebook. And so if people are listening or going to the archive, you can click on to Jason's information. But if you could please share your contact information for our live audience today, I'd appreciate it.
Sure, definitely. Jason Greifenberg, the best way to get a hold of me is through my phone, which is 734-812-0596. Again, 734-812-0596. You can call, leave a message, or text always works as well. You can also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/comptool. Again, facebook.com/comptool. And my email address is jason@comptool.net.
Fantastic. Well, Jason, fast 15 minutes, so I really appreciate all the information you shared, and your knowledge and expertise is something that's second to none as far as I'm concerned. So thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for the opportunity. We appreciate everything you do for us, Al. Thanks again.
Take care, buddy. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Okay. So we're going to move on. Our next guest is going to be David Herbeck. And David's actually a member as well of the Wayne Oakland Evening Chapter. And he's a financial advisor, and he's with Pilsner, Marshall, and Herbeck. So we're going to bring him on right now. David, how are you?
Hey, Al, I'm doing great. How are you?
Do you prefer Dave or David?
Dave's fine. Yeah, Dave works.
Okay, cool. I just thought it's one of those things where I know we write our name one way, but we like to be called something else, so I'll do it that way. So I have a question. I'm always curious for people that are specialized categories like yours, what was your motivation? Why did you decide to become a financial advisor?
So that's a great question. And, yeah, thank you very much, Al, for having us. This is a great opportunity, and you do a fantastic job. So thank you again. The main motivation has always been just a desire, basically, to both be in the financial services market, just because it's a great opportunity to be a student of the market and kind of know what's going on a day-to-day basis, but also to help and serve others, because it can be a very complicated and complex situation. And so to be able to sit down and help others and really help them towards their goal, towards retirement, is just a very rewarding feeling.
And I think that what you do is probably the most – I think it's probably the most special part of the relationships that I know that I have, because you really hold everybody's future in your hands. And so a couple of things I'd like you to kind of share is, you know, how long you've been in the industry, and what are your credentials?
Yeah, thanks, Al. And that is a responsibility that I take very, very seriously. And so I've been in the industry, I've been a student of the market really for about 10 years, and I've spent about 5 years with Raymond James, and I've been with the Making Investing Personal team with Sigma and Fidelity here for a little over a year. And so as far as credentials go, there's a couple of different things. The first is basically the Series 7 and the Series 66, which just allows you to buy and sell securities and act as an investment advisor to take discretion over client accounts. But the other thing, and this is something more recently that I just went through, is the AIF exams. So basically what that does is it allows you to become an accredited investment fiduciary. And that's a really interesting topic, Al, because right now, more recently, the Department of Labor actually had a rule. They're looking to basically force all brokers to become fiduciaries. The current rule is what's called the suitability standard. And so just to kind of touch on that for a second, the suitability standard basically says you have an investment product. Is it in your client's frame of reference for what they want to do? Is it suitable for that client? And The fiduciary standard, however, is a legal obligation to actually act in your client's best interest. And so that AIF examination is actually really, really important. People kind of need to realize that the suitability standard, even though it might be suitable for you, that doesn't necessarily equate to being in your best interest based on costs, return, expectations, and things of that nature. So it's pretty important for people to kind of be on the lookout for that. And finally, I'm actually excited. I'll be graduating with my MBA next month. Wow. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Congrats. So
thank you.
Do you have, as a financial planner and all the different things that you know that encompasses, is there something specific that you really specialize in?
So good question. I would consider what we do is holistic financial planning. So really what that means is looking at the entire financial ecosystem of a client to ensure that their goals towards retirement and their family situation, beneficiaries are accounted for, college planning, tax planning, really the big picture of it all. But I guess the main specialty, which is what differentiates us, is we brand ourselves as making investing personal, because really the way that it's been done is a very cookie cutter, you know, situation. And we want it to be as personal of a process as we can make it, so that we really get to know the client. We build that relationship and we make ourselves accessible even after business hours. And we're going above and beyond to provide them with the best customer service available. And so while we do provide a plethora of financial services, specializing in customer service is something that we really hold dear.
Okay, that's amazing. Well, thank you. Thanks for that response. Something I got to ask you about this right now is what's your take on the current market environment? I mean, it just seems like if I watch the ticker, you know, on the, you know, the stock market, I'm seeing that it's up, it's down, and people are either celebrating or they're jumping out of windows. You know, what's your take on what's going on right now?
It's so true. That is so true. We've really seen the reemergence of a lot of market volatility. You're exactly right. We have triple-digit point swings, it seems, almost on a regular basis now. So it has been pretty challenging. You know, to date, the market's pretty much flat on the year. And something that is interesting is the average length of a bull market is roughly 9 years, and we're actually past that mark. And so there's arguments to be made on both sides with regards to, you know, where we go from here. But something that is kind of interesting is that a lot of this growth really has been driven by the low interest rate environment. And unfortunately, instead of organic growth, we've also seen a lot of financial engineering going on with regards to companies buying back their stock in record numbers. And what that serves to do is basically reduce the amount of shares outstanding, so it drives up the price. And, you know, as we see the cost of borrowing going up, that could potentially have a negative impact on the market. But nobody has a crystal ball. You know, people really need to make sure that they're investing for the long term and that they're allocated responsibly based on their risk tolerance and their goals and their objectives.
And I think that's why, you know, and these are the things that I'll listen to people, and there's certain things that you can do yourself. Like, you can cut your own grass, but you don't pull your own teeth, and you sure as heck don't do your own financial planning. That's something you got to talk to a professional. So for somebody who's listening, that's kind of on the, you know, that's kind of unsure about, you know, what to do, can you kind of explain what your process is?
Yeah. So Al, the first step is just a conversation. We really want to make it a priority to have that conversation with the client to make sure that we're a good fit, and that what we do really aligns with what they're looking for. From there, we have the client basically fill out what's called a questionnaire that determines their goals, objectives, and their risk tolerance. And then it's a four-step process as far as the fiduciary standard goes through the AIF exam. It's called organize, formulate, implement, and monitor. And it's a very important process. The last one being the most important is monitoring. It's not a set it and forget it situation. What we do is we go through a very, very rigorous process of scanning for certain investments that are top performers in their category, They have a great track record and a long management tenure as far as their investment philosophy goes as well. So we're always monitoring that and making sure that the client is always allocated properly and that they're in balance with what their original risk tolerance is and their goals and objectives.
Okay. Is there a minimum that somebody has to be able to invest to be able to work with you?
Well, we really like to work with everybody. We don't want to turn anybody away. And so as a gesture of goodwill, we always provide certain advice and alternatives to anybody that that really looks for that type of help. However, from a financial perspective, it makes sense for some people to kind of use a more cheaper alternative, and we can kind of give them guidance based on that. So typically, $10,000 or more is sort of the minimum account size, but we definitely do help others that fall below that threshold.
Yeah, I've talked to financial planners before that said if you don't have $250,000, they're not going to talk to you. So I thank you for having that flexibility. That's amazing. Another question is, I think for kind of the baby boomer generation, is there an age where it's too late?
Absolutely not. I think for anybody that's looking to start saving money, it's never too late to do that. And that's the most important thing too, is stressing to on the opposite end of that spectrum is the power of compound interest and making sure that we're teaching young kids as well the power of compound interest and making sure that they're investing so that their money gets put to work very early on. And so that way they're in a much better position. But also at the other end of the spectrum, no, we really encourage everybody to always take a look at their financial situation, and there's never a too late time to start.
I guess my motivation and response would be is that if you do not want your parents to live with you, make sure that they're investing. And if you don't want to live, live with your parents when you're 50, you need to be investing now. So I think the parent thing could be your motivation, right?
absolutely. And there's so much going on. It really is kind of a challenging time, just with, you know, there's a lot of student loan debt out there. There's a lot of personal debt that's out there. Healthcare costs are increasing. So it can be challenging. It's a very difficult process for a lot of people, but there is a way forward, and that's where we like to come in and try to help and provide that way.
Yeah, because I think what people have to understand is that you're not going to survive off of Social Security, and there's no guarantee that it's even going to be there, you know, when we're going to be able to collect it. So the things that you need to do, you need to act now. And like he said, is that it's never too late. So if you want to have a quality of life, you know, the people that do the 30 and out, and it's like, okay, can you live off of that forever? And it's like, yeah, I can, but I'm going to eat ramen noodles 5 days a week. That's not really, you know, what I'm looking for. And I think that for our generation, like my generation, it was like, it began with everybody having retirements and 401ks and stuff. Those are mostly gone now. And so if people don't have direction and don't have somebody like yourself to guide them, it could be a pretty scary thing later in life.
No, that's very true. It's a do-it-yourself system now. You know, the pensions and those things like that, unfortunately, they have started to go by the wayside. And people, you know, even people that have them can't necessarily rely on them, unfortunately, because, you know, there's situations that come up. You know, we've seen Detroit, you know, go into a financial emergency and some restructuring that does unfortunately happen. So it's always good to have a professional taking a look and making sure that the do-it-yourself situation isn't that. You have partners that are there with you and professionals that can help you along the way.
Dave, is there any cost to sit down with you?
No cost. That's thank you for asking that, because it's a coffee and a conversation is the way that we like to approach it. Before we start getting into doing any business whatsoever, we like to sit down with people, have a cup of coffee, and just have a conversation and see if we're going to be a good fit. And then we go from there.
All right, cool. So if they got like 10 grand available on a credit line on a credit card, they can sign up and you can start investing that and make a millionaires, right?
There you go.
I'm
exactly. Exactly.
Now where I was going with that. So unfortunately, we have actually used up all of our time. So for our audience, if they're interested in learning more about what you can do for them and to help their lives and family and children be safe, what's the best way to reach out to you?
Sure. They can get me directly by calling my cell phone, 734-536-9549. And they can also email me at dave@makinginvestingpersonal.com. And I would look forward to having that opportunity to speak with them.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and your knowledge. And thank you for being on today's show.
Thank you, Al. Really appreciate everything that you do.
Good. No problem. Take care, buddy. See you later.
You too.
Bye-bye. Okay, we're going to move on. Next, we're going to bring on Mary. Actually, she goes by Marvelous Mary Novak. And we'll bring her on now. Hi, Mary. How are you?
Hey, I'm great, Al. How are you today?
I'm really, really good. It's one of those things where I love doing the show, and I love action, and it's just amazing the information that you guys are able to share with our audience, and the quality and knowledge and expertise you bring is just second to none. So thank you for being on today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to sharing some good information with you and your listeners today.
Cool. So one of the things that we keep hearing is that at least people that are paying attention is that it's a hot real estate market. And so I think that there's
right.
a different interpretation of what that means. Can you kind of explain what's going on in today's housing market?
I definitely can. We have no inventory, which means for buyers, it's a bidding war. It's first come, first serve. A lot of people are paying over asking price. But it also means that once a seller puts their house on the market, immediately it's going to get sold. But we have low inventory due to the fact that sellers are afraid to list their home in case they can't find one to move into. And but that's the one. Yeah. So that's a lot of their fear is, okay, we put our house on the market, but there's nothing out there for us to move into. What are we going to do? Well, that's where you want to work with a good realtor who knows how to negotiate occupancy. So a lot of times what we do is put it in the purchase agreement and then the listing agreement that the offer, the purchase agreement, is contingent on the seller finding adequate housing within a certain amount of time. So that seems to be working out really well.
Yeah, I mean, I have one of my buddies who doesn't live around here, but what he did is he didn't have somebody like you working with him, and what they're actually doing is they sold their house, and now they're going to have to live with the in-laws for a month until they can close on their
wow.
house. And I was just going like, why didn't you ask if I know somebody? Because I know there's people like Mary that can
right.
take care of you, make sure that who wants to live with their in-laws for a freaking month, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But, you know, a lot of times also I'll have sellers that'll say, I'm going to sell my house, but you know what? I'm going to move into an apartment for 6 months so I don't feel pressured on purchasing the first house that becomes available for me. So then that allows
wow.
the seller adequate time to take their time and find exactly what they're looking for. But then on the other end, that also when they write an offer on a house, they are a good purchaser because they can tell the seller, we can accommodate your occupancy needs.
Got it. Very cool. That's good to know. And again, that's kind of my aha thing for our conversation. So cool. So one of the things I have a question as well is like, so what price point seems to be selling the quickest right now?
I'll tell you what, anything under the $225,000 price point, if it's in a good if property's in good condition, good location, we're seeing multiple offers and over asking price. So be prepared if you have a house that, let's say, is in a Brighton, for instance, you're going to list it for $225,000. You're going to have people beating down the front door to get to it. You might as well go away for the weekend and just allow showings for the 48 hours that you're gone. And
wow.
be understand that you'll probably have two or three offers to review when you get back.
Well, here's a question that I have then, is that if there are multiple offers, what is it that you
right.
bring to the table that gets your offers accepted?
Well, a good strong offer is somebody who puts down a nice earnest money deposit instead of $1,000. Put your money where your mouth is. So put $3,000, $5,000, $6,000 as an earnest money deposit. You definitely want to be pre-approved because you want your agent to include your pre-approval letter from your lender with your offer. occupancy plays a big role. The less contingencies you have, the better. But obviously, you still want to have your home inspection, and you do still want to have it appraised to value, particularly if you're getting a mortgage. And I'll tell you what, cash, everybody thinks cash is king. Cash is nice. But I have seen instances where mortgages have won out over cash offers. Depending on if it's the buyer's agent, if they are able to sell that client to the other agent, that, you know, let's say, for instance, young client. I'll give you a great example. My husband and I, a million years ago, bought a condo. Interest rates were 18, or cottage. Interest rates were probably 18% back then. It was in the 80s, back in the dark ages. And we went in there with a land contract, 0% interest, okay? We were putting $10,000 down on maybe a $40,000 piece of property. And our agent said to my husband, she's not going to accept that with the 0% interest, not when, you know, she knows that she can get X, Y, and Z. My husband said, your job is to present it. I wasn't a realtor then. He presented it. She had seen us actually look at her cottage, and my husband and I were young. We were probably 30, had two little kids. And seeing that a young family was going to be utilizing the cottage as a grandma that she had used, that sealed the deal. She accepted her offer. Right. She didn't even come back and negotiate.
Wow. Yeah, and those are things that you've learned in life that allow you to be able to understand and see that and help that family to get the deal accepted. So that's beautiful. That's amazing. Thank you for that.
I've had quite a few of those types of situations where it's the seller is looking at the family that's coming in. Because, you know, they're giving up. When they're selling their home, they probably have raised their family there. They love it. They want a young couple perhaps coming in and loving it as much as they did.
Yeah, very nice. Very nice. Something that, and I guess I look at this a little more cynically than others, but I see the person, not the company, when I look at a realtor. You know, so Mary's Mary, you know, no matter where you're working, you're the pure marvelous Mary in my eyes. But I did notice that you had switched actually from Remax over to 3DX. What was up with that switch, and how has it changed, you know, your process or your situation?
Well, I tell you, I love Remax. I was with them for 12 years, but I looked at really looked at my business, and I thought, I'm a local agent, and I don't need international exposure. So I started looking for smaller boutique-type real estate companies to work with. I'm an independent contractor. So I interviewed a couple, and I decided to go with 3DX. It's well, they have about 200 agents in Michigan. They still provide me with all the support that I need. Our main office is in Novi. I do work out of our Brighton office. But just as you said, when you're getting ready to buy or sell a house, who is it that you hire? Is it the real estate company or the realtor? Well, the last couple of years when I look at my book of business, about 95% of my business is based on referrals. So to me, that means I must be doing something right to pass clients to come back to me and also refer their families and friends to have me work with them. So that was when I really realized that I can work for a large broker or I can work for a small boutique company and perhaps even provide better service because I don't have the overhead working with a larger company. So it's been a great move for me. I'm very happy that I did make the move.
Yeah, and I love 3DX. They're a great company. I know a couple other realtors that are there, and I've just seen incredible stuff. And it just seems like I think they're ahead of the curve as far as the different things, the technology they've embraced and stuff. So congrats for being a part of that group.
Yeah, thank you.
So Mary,
let
me ask you, now, can I call you Mary? Is it got to be marvelous too? Can I just call you Mary? Is that okay?
Oh, you can call me Mary. That's fine. That's fine. Right. But I got to tell you, you know, people will call up my office. They don't even know my last name. They just know me as Marvelous Mary. So, but you can call me Mary.
Okay, cool. And actually, I guess I do remember your name. Because I was starting thinking, like, do I know your last name? I'm like, okay, I do know your last name, but that's cool. So what I've noticed is that it seems like realtors have although they can help everybody, they seem to have kind of a niche or a group that they have a special affinity to. And it seems like your focus is really on that 60-plus segment. Is that correct?
It definitely is. I decided to move in that segment partly because I am over 60. I know, 64, if you believe it. Hold on, can't wait for Social Security to show up. But part of it is that I also went through the down. My husband and I actually had a successful downsize a few years back. We both had some health issues, and we had to downsize ourselves from a 3,000 square foot house on 4 acres down to, you know, a much smaller home. And I consider it a successful downsize, because I was able to be proactive rather than reactive. I saw the writing on the wall. I knew that this was coming down the line, and I did not want to be a burden to my children. But I think more importantly was that, on the other hand, my mother-in-law became, she was in her 80s, and all of a sudden everything fell to my husband, and being the oldest son, and he was dealing with he was already probably 68 at that time, dealing with his own health issues, and it really, it was quite a chore and somewhat burdensome. So I just decided to work on to help those 60 plus that are thinking about downsizing. And the system that I have put in place is that I have vetted vendors in various areas to help homeowners or their families, because a lot of times this does fall to the families if you have an elderly parent, to prepare to sell the family home or even the inherited home. By vetting my vendors have also agreed to be paid at close, out of the closing proceeds when the home is sold. Because a lot of seniors are on a fixed income, and they just don't have the money to hire a painter, hire someone maybe to garden or update some electric. So this way I have the vendors that'll do it. And not only that, I can also meet the vendors there, especially since a lot of children of, you know, the elderly perhaps live out of state. So I also, part of my mission is to meet the vendors, make sure the work is done, make sure it's done correctly, and just make it a stress-free process for everybody. Because when you're cleaning out your family home, it is very emotional. You know, you're looking at 30 years of things that, you know, you've acquired, memories, raised your children. And a lot of times when people think of downsizing, they think of it as the last move before the coffin. But downsizing shouldn't be negative. I like to call it right-sizing, because your biggest asset typically is your home. So if you sell your home and you're able to walk away with money in your pocket and move to an apartment or assisted living, you can use those funds to enjoy your life in your later years, whether it be, you know, go to the theater more or go on a few extra vacations. You're able to do that. And I just like to make it stress-free. And I tell my clients, you know what? When we're going through your house, there's going to be a few tears, but I guarantee you there's going to be a couple of laughs too. So it's just, I kind of take the bull by the horns and coordinate the whole shebang for everybody so that it can just be. Go ahead.
So I know you've actually created a website that people can look at for this. And could you please share that information, please?
Sure. It's downsizedlivingston.com. And it has all the information on there. And I also, the same process is very similar to the inherited property, too, because a lot of times family members will inherit property, and they just, because they're working, they have a family or they have health issues, they don't have time to go in there and, you know, clean out the property, get it ready and stage it for sale. So I also work with I call it the inherited homes too.
Nice. Yeah. I went through it myself last year with my mom, and it was something where, it definitely was a pain in the butt, and I'm the baby and this was all thrown in my lap. So, it's great to have those assets. We're almost out of time, but a couple other things I wanted to ask. Do you have a specific geographic area that you work in?
No, Well, I tell you, I'm licensed in the whole state of Michigan, so I can sell, list and sell property anywhere in the state of Michigan. But if I am called to work in an area that I'm not really familiar with, what I like to do is refer them to somebody that I have interviewed and approved, because I just think that everybody deserves to have top-notch service. And I would be doing my seller an injustice if I listed their house up in Houghton Lake, but I wasn't able to show it ever to anybody. So I prefer to refer those clients out. But my main area, obviously, is Livingston County, Genesee, Washtenaw, parts of Wayne, and Oakland County. But those are the main areas that I work at. But since I've been in the business for so long, I have a phenomenal network of other realtors that I can refer.
Fantastic. Well, if you could please share. So what I'm going to do is when the show is done, I'll share the links to your website and stuff on both the Network Squared fan page as well as your chapter fan page. I'll put that out there as well. But if you could please share your contact information for our live listeners, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. You can call me directly at 517-861-7064. And my email is marvelousrealtor@gmail.com. And what I do, you know, a lot of times people will ask me, do I charge to meet them? I don't charge anything. My consultation is always free. I tell my clients what I like to do. I believe that all decisions start with a conversation and a cup of coffee. And I'll even bring the coffee. I encourage to have other family members there when we meet so that everybody's kind of on the same page. And I can meet them either at my office or at their home. And then I have a list of questions that kind of help guide the conversation so that everybody understands what the expectations of the process is.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Mary, for being on. And you are absolutely marvelous in my eyes. So thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you. Okay. Have a great one. Thank you, Al. Bye.
Okay, our last guest today is going to be attorney Paul Groff, and we'll bring him on right now. Paul, are you there, buddy?
I'm here, Al. How are you doing?
I'm fantastic. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing great, thanks. A beautiful day out.
One of the things that I like when we have people in specialized categories is what was your motivation to become an attorney?
I didn't really go to start law school until after I worked for a few years after graduating college. I always was a history buff for one, American history, I should say, and it just really just seemed a natural segue for me to want to become a lawyer. So, I'm more of a person oriented person. I like to help people. And that sort of thing. So that's kind of how I got my start in law.
Pretty cool. Now, and I know that there's all different kinds of attorneys, and I know there's a few different things that you really specialize in. So I'm gonna kind of touch upon a couple of questions from the different categories that you offer, because you're definitely not a one-trick pony. You have a lot of different things that you're able to bring to the table as far as your practice. So I'm going to get into our questions now. So my first question is, I know bankruptcy is part of what you specialize in, and I know that there seems to be some confusion as to the different numbers. Can you explain what a Chapter 7 bankruptcy is?
Yeah, a Chapter 7 bankruptcy is what they call a liquidation bankruptcy that allows a person to discharge all of their dischargeable debts and get a fresh start. So that's, in a nutshell, what a seven entails.
And one of the things that I listened to, and I did mortgages for 24 years, so I'd come across this kind of stuff. And it's one of those things where, what are the things that you cannot discharge in a bankruptcy? And what about, like, if I own a house?
Well, things that you cannot discharge in the bankruptcy typically are, like child support, alimony, student loans for the most part, some taxes. When it comes to a secured debt, such as a mortgage or a car loan, you can you can discharge your personal obligation on those types of debts, but the creditor or the bank can still foreclose or repossess the vehicle, let's say, or the house. So that would be, I guess, in terms of a mortgage, it's typical, let's say, if there is not enough equity in the house, that a debtor could keep the house. And as long as they continue, and it really discharges the personal obligation on the note, but as long as they keep current on the payments, they would be able to retain that house. They wouldn't have to lose it in the bankruptcy.
Yeah, and this is where, to me, this becomes really important. Somebody very close to me, that they actually had a situation where they had filed, and they only owed like $15,000 on an $80,000 house, and they actually included the house in the bankruptcy. The attorney told them to include it.
Oh, wow.
So they ended up losing the house. If you don't think it matters who your attorney is, I honest to God, when I found out about this, I was so mad. But it was before I didn't know the people when this happened. And so I was just like devastated because I wanted to help them, but it was already too late, at that point. So so those are the things that we want to make sure in our loved ones.
And that's the first thing I ask in terms of the when I meet with clients, if they have a house, what's the mortgage balance? What's what's the fair market value? And so I don't want to see anyone lose their house in a Chapter 7. That's for sure.
Absolutely, and I can say that since I've been part of LBN, that it would never happen because I'd be talking to you, and that's the way I look at this. So one of the things, so for somebody who is thinking about a bankruptcy and Chapter 7 is where they think they need to go, what are the eligibility requirements for that?
Well, it primarily I look at when I initially meet with a proposed client, potential client, I want to see what their income level is. If it's just a single person, let's say not married, you can earn up to about almost $48,000 currently and still qualify for a Chapter 7. So your income would not be too high. If you have children or married, it really depends on the household income, but then the amount that the combined income of that family also increases as to what can be earned increases dramatically as well. So let's say a family of a married family of two and three children, I don't have the actual numbers in front of me, but it's, upwards of $80,000 a year in that type of situation.
Got it.
So you can file. So income is the key thing is what I would say as to eligibility.
Okay. Thank you. Now, there's also a Chapter 13 bankruptcy. So what's the difference between that and a 7?
Well, like I said, a 7 is a liquidation bankruptcy, designed to, wipe out your general unsecured debts, such as credit cards, medical bills. And if your assets are exempt under the bankruptcy code, your creditors will receive nothing. Again, typically this is for low-income debtors with little or no assets who want to get rid of unsecured debt. However, Chapter 13 bankruptcy, commonly referred to as a reorganization bankruptcy, is for debtors with regular income who can pay back a portion of their debts through a repayment plan. If you earn too much money to qualify for a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, you may really have no choice but to file a Chapter 13 bankruptcy. The payment plans usually last anywhere from 3 to 5 years. Some of the kind of creative things that can be done in the 13 allows people maybe to get caught up on this monthly mortgage or car payments, which isn't available in a Chapter 7.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, I have a really stupid question. Have you ever had somebody that tried to file a Chapter 7 by themselves without using an attorney?
I haven't had anyone or know of anybody, but when I go down for the 341 hearings downtown, let's say, or up in Flint, you see people there who are not represented by attorneys, not many, but a few here and there. And it really turns out to be where, the trustee isn't happy with the documents that they provided, because when you file, you have to provide all sorts of documents within 7 days of the creditors meeting. And typically they don't have the proper documents. They may not know what kind of exemptions they can take. So it's really a mess. And so I know those cases just repeatedly get adjourned, and I don't know how they ever resolve because I'm never around to see those. But but they're it's not a good way to go at all, in my opinion.
That's a horrible thing. I'm sorry to ask a dumb question like that, but it was just one of those things where there are certain things that you just don't do yourself, and a bankruptcy would absolutely be one of those that I wouldn't do. So I want to move on a little bit more, and I want to get into a little bit more of the criminal part. Can you go into common types of criminal cases that you handle?
Well, it's mostly the misdemeanor cases, not too much of the felonies, but mostly the misdemeanor cases, such as the drunk drivings, domestic violence type cases, traffic offenses. I should say that my office and myself personally, we've represented a number of municipalities over the years, and currently I do prosecute for Highland Township out of the Novi District Court, 521 Court there in Novi. So I'm every Tuesday morning, I'm sort of playing Let's Make a Deal on drunk drivings and in a lot of other cases. So, and I also, when I was in law school, I also clerked for a judge who, a district court judge, the Novi court then was in Walled Lake. It's since moved to Novi, but that's where I clerked for 3 years. So I really gained a good grounding and understanding of the district courts, the type of cases they handle. And so I've kind of just followed that in my practice. So it's mostly those misdemeanor cases that are only handled in the district courts.
We're running really kind of short on time. So I just wanted to go to just
that's
a couple
fine,
of things.
That's fine. I understand.
So a question that I think we run into is that I've never done something that I've done wrong. So I might make mistakes. So if I get pulled over, what are some of the mistakes that you see that your potential clients make that hurt them when they're trying to actually have a case?
Well, I think the most common mistake is that, maybe they make statements to the police that where they have a right to remain silent. And so I think that's the biggest mistake that clients make. Also, I think another mistake is that they get a little too aggressive maybe with a police officer, and that never helps the situation either, obviously.
Yeah.
But mostly it's a situation where they maybe talk too much and they have a right to remain silent and also a right to consult with a lawyer, to make a phone call to a lawyer if they want. And a lot of clients don't do that.
I want to kind of jump over into some criminal stuff. And again, it's cool you do all these different things. I think we'd have a whole show for just you. So one of the things that in a criminal case is, how do you advise clients who want to plead guilty in a criminal case? How do you handle that?
Okay. Well, first of all, I try to explain the consequences of doing so. Ultimately, it is their decision, but I also always want to be sure they understand everything that could happen. Often, a plea agreement can be reached, which lessens the consequences of the original charge, and it's important for the client to understand that possibility. It's also important that the client understands the potential consequences on their driver's license, financial aid for school down the road, employment opportunities, and also it's important that the client understands that being convicted of a crime, is reflected on their criminal history, which can have a negative consequence going forward. So those are things that I think, individuals need to know before they want to say, I want to plead guilty.
Okay. And so, in 30 seconds, you can do this, is that if somebody's looking to hire a criminal defense attorney, what are some of the red flags, or share one or two things that people need to be careful of?
Well, in terms of, I think, first of all, you find an attorney that's a good listener, pays attention to you and your story. An immediate red flag would be when the attorney appears maybe distracted. Other red flags could be lack of compassion or lack of preparedness. I think it's important for the attorney to have compassion to help you make a calm, rational decision when your emotions may be running high. Also, if the attorney is not prepared to answer your legal questions, that should also raise a red flag. And lastly, I would say, I would always be skeptical of any attorney who promises his client a specific outcome.
Okay, cool. We are against a hard break, so just I will share actually your contact information on Facebook and all the other social media because we are going to be out of time. Thank you so much. for our audience. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Al.
Today. As always, God bless America. Thank you so much, Paul, for being on today. Bye-bye.
No, Al, it's always great talking to you. Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.